This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Hyde County on the North Carolina coast is the site of one of the longest and most successful civil rights protests in American history. The African American community boycotted Hyde County schools in 1968 in response to the county's desegregation plan. Local school board didn't get any input from the black community and decided to close all the black schools. For a whole year, black citizens refused to send their kids to school. Instead, the students participated in marches, sit-ins, and protests. Demonstrators marched to Raleigh twice and persisted despite tear gas, angry white neighbors, and even a gun battle with the Ku Klux Klan. The boycott was successful and led to an integration plan that incorporated black schools. North Carolina just commemorated this movement with a state highway historical marker in Hyde County. Azalea Mackey was in elementary school at the time of the boycott, and she joins me now. Azalea, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing very well. You were in elementary school, so a young girl at the time this decision in the black community was taken. What do you remember about the decision itself and what was going on in that moment?
Well, when I think about it, you know, we all knew what the civil rights movement was. We saw it on TV every night. We had been through the Dr. King era and his assassination, so it just let me know that now it was going to be a part of our county. We were so southern and deep down, as they'd like to say, that not much touched us. But when they decided that the schools needed to boycott, we understood why, because like my first grade and second grade teacher lived with us. So to understand that we would lose them, or we wouldn't know them anymore, or they wouldn't teach us, or the places that we had been going and we knew as a central place for the community was going to disappear, even a child understood that. And by being exposed to the civil rights movement through television, we just understood that now that was going to come to our county.
What do you remember about the way the decision was made?
Well, I remember it through my parents and my aunts and uncles, how upset they were when they discovered, they knew integration was coming, it had to come. But when they understood that it was going to mean that the two schools that they had built over generations was going to just disappear and we wouldn't have access to them anymore, it made them angry. They were upset. And when they thought they were going to get a say, and they didn't get one. So immediately, for the first time, I saw this really docile community that really went along with the status quo decided to say no. And usually when they said no, they meant it. And they just took that on as a cause, and they just moved forward with it, with everything that they had.
Well, let's talk about what that meant. What do you remember about life during that year with the boycott in place? There had to be a lot of organization, also people doing things they didn't normally do, right?
Well, because it was centered in the church was a part of the community. So being at the church and being at meetings and being there at night, we didn't spend a lot of time there during the day, but they just incorporated it into the whole church movement. That's where we had meetings. That's where they had their strategy sessions. That's where people went to congregate and to talk, right? So having it there wasn't unusual. You know, the kids at a kid's level, you're happy, really, not to be in school.
Right.
But that didn't mean that you didn't have to do your homework or you didn't have to study. I think we had to spend more time with math and English and reading during that period than we would have been if we were in school. So it was just the fact that we didn't have to go to school and that we would meet at one church or another almost every night and actually plan the sessions for the next day. So as a kid at 9 years old, it was to me like it was television, right? It's the things that I have been seeing on TV for the last few years when someone got up to speak and talk about what we needed to do and how we needed to go about it. It was just like the speeches I had heard on TV, so it was fascinating in a way.
Talk about some of the activities that were actually being planned at these meetings. What kind of things were you doing?
The marches, you know, organizing where we're going to meet and how it's going to be carried out, even to the fact of how we were going to line up. You know, the male leaders were usually at the front, and the children were in the middle, and then the rest of everybody was at the end. They sort of wanted to cushion the children. But you got to remember that most of the people who were marching were from age 9 to 17. So it was a movement of children during the day being led. I mean, there were always adults present, but, you know, those adults had to work or whatever. But they were there at night planning it. They drop us off. They made sure we had food. You know, they made sure everybody was safe. And you were left with an aunt or an uncle or a cousin, you know, somebody from the community. But the sit-ins and the strategies of what they were going to do the next day for the teenagers. Now, the 9-year-old didn't get involved in letting chickens go in the middle of the town or playing basketball, things that would lead to arrest. But you will hear them planning that kind of thing for the next day.
What about the danger in all of this? Did it feel like a danger to you? Did people talk about the risks? You were facing some pretty dangerous situations, it seems to me.
No, they didn't visit on the kids the danger of it. You saw when you were actually marching, when you would see the police or the National Guard standing between you and the angry mob on the other side. To me, that's the only time that the fear would come up and you would see the guns and you were like, guns, you know, why do they have guns? And now the older kids understood, you know, you could be hit in the head or you could, something could happen to you. But the parents didn't dwell on the danger of it because they were ready to face it. And they knew if they were going to allow their kids to be a part of it, they had to be willing to protect them. So they took the fear themselves. They didn't pass it on to us. But you understood that there was some, when you saw the guns, you understood that there was more to it than just us singing songs and doing chants.
So we understand marches, we understand sit-ins, we understand singing. You said something about chickens. Tell me more.
Okay. So the leaders of the movement, Mr. Frank, would come up with creative ways to do civil disobedience or to cause arrest. Because one of the things, they wanted to fill the jails, they wanted to, you know, put a burden on the county and the state and whatever to do that. So they knew if they did things like the police would say, okay, you can't march in the street. So they would get in the street and play basketball. At one time, they had chickens, literally. And they released those chickens in the middle of Swan Quarter, which was the capital of Hyde County, and just let them fly about. You know, that's an immediate arrest, you know, because you're obstructing traffic, you're doing things. So they came up with nonviolent ways to be, to cause, you know, confusion. So one after the other, like the basketball and the chicken, letting the chickens go, was probably two of the most famous incidents that caused a lot of arrest.
Yeah, you talked about having to pursue or stay with your studies. Who was supervising your studies through all of this?
Our parents, other relatives. We even had, at one point, had school at church. Some of the churches, you go there during the day and they had books donated and writing pads back in the day where you printed your name and there was a pad designed for writing. We'd have our math. And we did that because they were trying to get those classes accredited so that would count toward, you know, have actually attend school during that year, but that didn't come about. So that went on for a few months. But me personally at home, I had to do a couple hours of math and spelling and reading every day, just to make sure that I didn't fall behind. I wasn't the only one.
You know, we talked about the fact that there was resistance. Obviously, white community was not going to stand by and let this happen. Did you have a sense that there was any, especially early on, again, you were 9 years old at the time, but I wonder if you had any sense that you were making progress.
That we were what, making progress?
Making any progress, that this thing was going to turn out, that it was going to be successful.
Well, we believed it. That was the sense. We believed that what we were doing was going to make a difference. And in the end, we would get what we had been protesting for, that we would save the school. There was never a doubt in the heart of us that that was going to happen. So you just went about the daily activities as you were told to do or to be a part of it, and you just believed that it was going to happen.
It certainly wasn't a given that one of the big confrontations came about with an actual shootout with the Ku Klux Klan. Do you remember that?
Yes, because our house was across the field from where the activity took place, about a couple of miles away. But, you know, in the where we live is very rural, so it was all farmland. So if you got gunshots happening out at night, you could see it. So we were sitting in the house with the lights out. Everybody who lived in our community, the women and children were inside. The men, you know, went and got their hunting rifles and their various guns and things to protect. And the younger, it was 4th of July, so there were a lot of people from the north who were down for the holiday. And literally, once they shot at the first car, they came back and told everybody that, you know, they were being shot at. So here we go with the caravan. Of course, you know, my mom and dad didn't go. And I was never been allowed to be there, but my brother was there. And they were literally, you could see the gunshot. You could see the fire from the bullets or gunshot in the distance. You could hear it. Right. So we were sitting quietly. And my mother said, no, we can't turn on any lights because, you know, they might shoot through the house and couldn't go outside. And it was hot. You know, it's July.
I'll tell you what, we're going to continue this conversation. I'm talking to Azalea Mackey, who is in elementary school at the time of the Hyde County school boycott. Today, talking about one of the longest and most successful civil rights protests in American history, happened right in rural Hyde County, North Carolina. The year was 1968. It was a boycott. Local officials created a school desegregation plan that would close the black schools. They did so without any input from the African-American community. Black students stayed out of school for a year and instead participated in marches, sit-ins, and demonstrations. Azalea Mackey is still with us. She was in elementary school at the time. And you talked about just before the break a shootout with the Ku Klux Klan on July 4th. Was anybody hurt?
Yes. A cousin of mine, who was 12 at the time, got shot in the leg, and I think it was ricochet. It ricocheted off of something because she was in one of the cars that was out there and discovered them there at first. She was riding with her sister and her sister's boyfriend, who were older, and they were just, you know, riding through the neighborhood on a summer night and discovered that when they went by, they shot at them.
And no one was killed in that particular.
No one was killed. Some of the officers, a couple of the officers were injured, but nobody died.
Well, I want to scope back a little bit and get a kind of a bigger picture of what was happening at the time. We talked about this being 1968, the civil rights movement, this part of the civil rights movement in full bloom. David Soselsky joins us now. He's a historian and an author of several books, including Along Freedom Road, Hyde County, North Carolina, and the Fate of Black Schools in the South. David, welcome back.
It's nice to be here. It's nice to be here with Azalea.
Tell us a little bit about what was happening generally. I know you've written this book, and we'll talk more about what you found out and talking to the many people involved in this. But in North Carolina in general, what was happening around this time around desegregation?
Ever since the Brown versus the Board of Education decision in 1954, whites in North Carolina, and particularly Eastern North Carolina, had fought against bringing the black and white schools together, against having black and white children in the same classrooms. Eventually, civil rights protest and the federal courts had pushed local school districts to integrate. But when they integrated, when desegregation finally occurred in Hyde County and throughout the state, the pattern that began to be clear was that the African American schools were going to be closed, the black principals would be fired, many black teachers would lose their positions. African-American children were often came to feel like aliens within the new desegregated schools, like where I grew up, where African-American children were shunted into disproportionately into special education classes. Rates of punishment were, you know, and suspension were very high for African-Americans. All symbols of the African, what was a very proud tradition of African American education, were eliminated. Schools, you know, everything from trophy cases to cultural events. what was so extraordinary to me in Hyde County is that in most places, African-American communities said, this is all unfortunate, but for the greater good of bringing black and white children together in classrooms, we feel like maybe these are sacrifices we can live with. The African-American community in Hyde County said, no, we believe in bringing black and white children together. But if it's going to be a one-way street, if our children are going to be treated this way, in this hurtful way, if you're going to crush their aspirations for intellectual accomplishment and for, you know, sustaining communities, then no, we would rather keep our own schools, we would rather keep our own teachers, we would rather keep our own way of taking care of children and educating them in a caring environment, one connected to the community, one that never gives up on a child.
Azalea, this had to be a difficult conversation within the African-American communities in Hyde County that were discussing this. I know, again, you were only 9 at the time, but did you have a sense at the time, or have you learned since, that there were some pretty strong disagreements about how to proceed over this?
Well, in some aspects, the majority of people agreed. There were dissenters. There were a few people who were very outspoken about how they thought it should go, or how they wanted it to be. There were a few who opposed. But overall, I think the county, the whole county of African Americans were mostly together. And they were willing to compromise. You know, it didn't have to be keep the schools completely black or the schools completely white, but let's share in the compromise. Let's, you know, give and take on both sides, not the black community having to bear the brunt of all of it, you know, and not have a say in or even a voice to speak about the opportunity to compromise.
Well, David, I was going to say, David, you said this was a unique situation or almost unique situation, whereas, you know, in the state of North Carolina and probably everywhere else in the South, what were the white leaders saying in Hyde County, and how did they initially respond? Did they think this whole thing was going to blow over, or what was their initial response?
Well, I'd be interested in what Azalea had to say about that, but I think they were almost dazed. You have to remember that there had been very little civil rights activism of any kind in Hyde County up to this point. And then all of a sudden you have their county is on the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times. And once the young people like Azalea and her older cousins got involved, they weren't only struggling to save their schools. They began to integrate businesses and to look for living wages in the fields and to look for respect and voting rights and all kind of endeavors. For many white leaders, they could not imagine a world in which one would want to save the African American schools. Their idea was that they were inherently inferior. While in my experience, the African-American community in Hyde County talked about its schools as if they were Harvard and Yale. It went beyond, you know, I mean, they would always say that, yes, we had worse secondhand books and they had had to build their own buildings and find their own land and parents had to volunteer. But they believed that over 100-plus years history, they had built a tradition of African-American education that respected character and had a high level of excellence and was the way you would want your children to be raised. And so those two visions came in conflict.
Wait, in your research, what did you find, or how did you find the conversations going in white leadership and the white community in terms of how it was going to respond and then how they changed over time? Because ultimately, there is a resolution. It takes a year. But what was going on in that year in white circles of power?
Well, it was an endurance battle, Frank. This boycott lasted a year. It was daily marches and protests. They filled the jails, not only in Hyde County, but all the way to Raleigh. They wore down the white leadership. Eventually, other white leaders, state level, national white leaders, become concerned and start applying pressure to those local white leaders. People in African-American communities all over North Carolina begin going, well, actually, we have these same concerns. We're losing our teachers. Our children are getting suspended. Our children are being, we no longer feel welcome in the public schools. Our teachers used to come knock on our door if our child had a problem. So boycott, school boycotts, and other kinds of protest over these same issues began happening across North Carolina, and they began happening across the South. A lot of this brings pressure on to the white leadership in Hyde County. And at a certain point, there is a compulsion, I should say, to negotiate in a serious fashion and work out a solution.
I get a sense on the ground of how this organization worked out. I want to bring Alice Spencer Mackey into the conversation now. Alice was in high school during the movement, and she played a role in this as well. Alice, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
Tell me about your role. What were you doing? You were in high school, a little bit older than Azalea. What were you doing?
Well, actually, I was in 11th grade. So when everything started, you know, at first I was a little skeptical, but then all at once I decided that I wanted to stay out of school and be the school system was something to me. Davis School, I was a student at Davis School, and to me, to go to school was very important. So when I heard about what was going to happen, I just immediately was ready to step out and do whatever I could. And actually, as a young person, there wasn't a lot of fear in young people. You know, young people are not scared of much. Mm-hmm. So when all the things that started happening, there was no fear in me, but I was just determined that I was going to be a part of this history making to keep our school. So, I mean, everything fell into place as far as the movement was going and the daily demonstrations or whatever. I was involved in that. And I even had a part of writing news release and to the News and Observer and to Virginia Pilot to help with things to get out the press to let them know what was going to happen, when it was going to happen, to contact leaders to come into the county as far as, you know, for different demonstrations. So to me, it was a big education. I was being educated in two ways, yes.
Well, it also sounds to me like given the roles that you had, this means that somebody had defined those roles, which suggests some really, really top-notch organizing. Talk about the organization.
Yes, yes. And there's one thing about the movement. It was very well organized. It was organized from what we was going to do from the first hour of the day until that night. Everything was organized because if it wasn't organized, somebody could get hurt. Everybody had something to do, and it was made sure that everyone, if you was assigned to do a class, if you was assigned to demonstrate with the chickens, if you was assigned to use a basketball or jump rope, everybody knew what they were supposed to do. So that's why nobody really got hurt.
It's interesting. You said 11th grade, so then you finished high school when this was over. You didn't have much of an experience of the newly integrated school system. But what did you learn? What did you take away from this experience?
I tell you, when I went back to school, you know, when I left school, I was maybe a C, low B. But when I went back to school, I was making A's. I mean, I had learned so much by being actually hands-on, being in the community, meeting people. It was just a great experience for me, and I realized that if I had not gotten out to demonstrate and to be a part of the movement, I probably wouldn't, when I got back into my regular school, I would probably have been the same way I was because I was exposed to more things, actually.
Azalea, what was what were schools like? Again, you were 9 years old at the time, so when you went back, things were now changed, and you were in the system for a while. How had things changed? What was it like to be in the newly integrated system?
Well, it was the first time we'd ever had white teachers, and luckily, so when I went back to school, the first year of integration was fourth grade, and of course, I was a year behind. We were a little older than the white kids, but our teachers, two of them were young white teachers, maybe out of college 1 or 2 years, sort of hippie-like. So they had a lot of liberal and progressive ideas. We didn't have to deal with, you know, someone who was from High County who still had that High County mentality about education, because they came from a place outside of the county where they were already in tune with the civil rights movement, and they didn't make a difference between the white kids and the black kids, right? They made everybody feel welcome. Now, that's at the elementary level. And we, at that level, the kids didn't have any preconceived ideas. You know, like the teenagers, I think it was different for them. Mm. It was much different. And so by the time we got to high school, we had been with those kids for years. So we knew them. We had formed our own relationship outside of the politics that was going on. So there were instances, but there were not in any way like the older kids experienced when they went back to school for the first year.
And David Soselsky, talk about the details of this and how it was actually resolved. There were two plans, right, ultimately. And so talk about the ways in which African-American communities were brought back in and ultimately what happened.
Well, eventually, of those two plans, a plan is conceived that would keep open all three schools. Two of them had historically been African American. All three schools would be maintained. All African American leadership would be maintained. No African American teachers were fired. There was a plan. There was a governing committee created for how to run set policy at the high school that was teachers and students in equal numbers. And frankly, at that point, the Hyde County Board of Education was so worn down that many of the most fundamental policy decisions were relegated to, they took over.
Mm-hmm.
And they handled issues as symbolic as where does the trophy cases from the African-American schools and the white schools go, and how do you handle prom kings and queens to make sure everybody is, you know, included, to the creation of African-American history classes, to who's going to be, what kind of leadership is going to happen in the next generation. There was already a plan for alternating between black and white principals, and it was a very extraordinary resolution, and it doesn't mean that there weren't problems to be resolved. But in many ways, compared to what was happening in the rest of North Carolina at that time, it was really an extraordinary, extraordinary achievement.
Well, and I understand the state of North Carolina now has dedicated a memorial plaque along the highway in Hyde County. So, Alice and Azalea, congratulations to you. And Azalea, talk about this, because I understand you're one of the people who helped organize the 50th anniversary celebration for the boycott when that came around. Talk about that celebration and how people responded to that.
Well, one of my friends, Sandy Fentress, her grandmother was a leader in the movement. And she said to me once, a couple years ago, before the anniversary date came up, we should do something to commemorate the boycott. So we messed around for a year or so. And then when she kept saying, okay, Mac, we're going to do this, we need to do this, we need to do this, I did the math and realized that the 50th anniversary was coming up, and we're like, definitely. So the community came out. They responded well, and they brought their children and their grandchildren. And one of the scenes I remember seeing, one of the ladies from the movement, girls from the movement, who's now a woman and had children and grandchildren, her picture was on the wall, right? And she had been injured at a fall from the courthouse. And she had her grandchildren with her and her children with her. And they were explaining, and they got to see the exhibits. And they had all heard about it, I'm sure, at some point. But, you know, it was 50 years ago. Now they got to see it in pictures. They got to hear speakers come. They got to hear actual participants who were prominent figures tell their story, and some of them for the first time had spoke openly about it, and they haven't, you know, because they were teenagers then, but now they were adults and we got to hear it from the horse's mouth, sort of to speak. So it was a fantastic day. It was all encompassing, you know, learning the history, celebrating it, commemorating it, and just letting the younger generation understand that, you know, it's possible. Look what your grandmother and your grandfather and your mom did 50 years ago. So if they could do that, what can you accomplish today?
Azalea Mackey, and also spoke with Alice Spencer Mackey, both part of the Hyde County School boycott. Azalea was in elementary school, Alice in high school. Also David Soselsky, a historian and author of several books, including Along Freedom Road, Hyde County, North Carolina, and The Fate of Black Schools in the South. I want to thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you very much, Frank.
You're welcome.
And congratulations. North Carolina just commemorated the Hyde County school boycott with a state highway historical marker.